Thanks for downloading the Analysis Extra podcast, in which Martin Wolf, chief economics commentator of the Financial Times, presents the second of a two-part series, New Global Economics. As financial crises rage on, the enormity of the changes to the world's economic foundations are becoming more understood. What permanent shifts will the world have to come to terms with as we try to get back on the road to growth and stability? Here's Martin Wolf with part two, The Shift.
The world is changing. The advanced countries are mired in excessive debt and submerged by waves of financial crises. Government finances are under stress. The capitalist system is under attack. China and other emerging economies are growing in economic importance. On the global stage, the advanced countries have lost their moral and intellectual authority. Emerging countries may not have liked their pretensions, but they did respect their competence. That is true no longer. What we are witnessing then is transformation in an age of debt. How will the world cope with these shifts? A question for Mohamed El Erian, chief executive of the world's largest bond fund.
This is an historic period. We're going to look back and say this was a time of major change. And the only question out there is how orderly or how disorderly will this be? The great age, great not in the sense of it was wonderful, but great in the sense that it went too far, the great age of leverage, of debt, and of credit entitlement is going to be reversed, and that's going to be a very painful process that's going to result in slow growth, persistently high unemployment, and sovereign debt issues. And the new reality is going to be a multipolar world, one in which the West has to make room in its own interest for systemically important emerging economies.
Protests against the excesses and unfairness of contemporary capitalism have now sprung up in the heart of the markets, Wall Street in New York and St. Paul's Cathedral in the City of London. Adair Turner, chairman of the UK's Financial Services Authority, once famously described much of the output of the banking sector as socially useless. So how does he defend the system?
I think a lot of ordinary people have a right to be very annoyed with the way that the financial system developed, and the way that through, bluntly, intellectual failures of understanding, it was allowed to develop by the official policy sector. I think the crucial thing is to take that anger and make sure that it gets expressed and reflected in really effective policy response. That policy response should not involve throwing over the market economy. For all its faults, the market economy is the best thing humanity has been able to create for taking people out of poverty. And a market economy, which is also a global economy, will have quite a large and quite a sophisticated financial sector. But that makes it all the more important that we have really robust regulation, and that faced with that complicated system, we are always on our guard against people using that complexity to tell us that we can't regulate, and also obfuscating the elements of that complexity which are required to service a complex global market economy, and those which, frankly, are simply profit-making opportunities for some rather privileged people within society.
Adair Turner, chairman of the soon-to-be-disbanded Financial Services Authority. Mohamed El Erian, a former senior official of the International Monetary Fund, is chief executive of PIMCO, a powerful influence upon world markets. Are we making big mistakes in our understanding of contemporary capitalism?
The developed world is having a major problem recognizing that its status has changed. It still hasn't understood that much of the growth that came in the mid-2000s wasn't genuine growth. It was based on leverage. I cite two things that I think were really interesting. I work in the financial service industry. At some stage in the mid-2000s, the name of the financial service industry morphed from being called the financial services to the financial industry. And we lost sight of the fact that the financial service industry serves the real economy. So we got a very lopsided economy that was over-dependent on finance. Then there was another big mistake in the mid-2000s. Policymakers thought that capitalism had a new stage. So the old way of thinking of capitalism was a transition from agriculture to industry to services. Suddenly, there was this notion that financial sector was the next natural step in capitalism. And a few economies, particularly the US and the UK, embraced that as if it was a natural stage of capitalism. Now we have to reverse these two mistakes, and they're big mistakes.
How long is this going to take? What sort of period should we be thinking about? Are we talking about a few years, a decade, many decades?
Back in 2009, we came out with this concept that the global economy was on a bumpy road to a new normal. So there's a journey and there's a destination, and people have to realize that. The journey will take at least 5 years. The destination will look different. The reason why it will take 5 years is because we're not going to get growth. Economic growth allows you to maintain living standards and allows you to pay off debt. Unfortunately, the West will not get enough economic growth to safely delever. There's too many structural impediments that have been left to fester.
Obviously, if you're talking about mass deleveraging, there's a possibility that this could go very seriously wrong. We have everybody cutting back at the same time. And when everybody cuts back at the same time, John Maynard Keynes taught us, we get a depression. So what is the risk of that?
The risk is clearly there. There's one silver lining, which is that there are healthy balance sheets in the system. The multinational companies are as healthy as I've ever seen them. I'm 53 years old. I've been following them for a while. I have never seen multinational with such strong balance sheets. They have over $4 trillion of cash on their balance sheet. They have termed out their debt, and they're still making profits. You have the consumer in emerging economies that have the wallet to spend, but not the will to spend. If they get the will to spend, they can help the safe delevering of the world. And you have a number of countries, including Germany, that are surplus countries. If the policymakers can convince these healthy balance sheets to engage, then the prospects for the global economy will not be as dire. If all we get is austerity, then this will be really bad news.
Such one-sided pressure on over-indebted borrowers to reduce spending is having a dangerous impact on the eurozone, where the pain of austerity is acute in some countries, especially Greece. Back in 2007, eurozone leaders thought the financial crisis was of little concern to them. Then they realized it was important after all, since there had been far too much bad lending and excessive debt in the eurozone too. Finally, they have come to realize that the survival of the euro and even of the post-Second World War European project is at stake. I asked Paul de Groot, professor at the University of Leuven in Belgium, whether the Europeans can make the decisions needed to fix their crisis.
We have now moved into a banking crisis that is almost solely due to the fact that we have a sovereign debt crisis in the eurozone. And therefore, in order to make sure that the banks do not go down, we have to stop the decline in the prices of government bonds of a number of countries. And I'm thinking of Italy, Spain, and a few others, also now France and Belgium, in order to prevent a full-scale banking crisis. And again, the only institution that can do that is the European Central Bank. But unfortunately, it doesn't want to do it for, in my view, dogmatic reasons. And as a result, all kinds of gimmicks and tricks are being thought of to avoid the European Central Bank to take action itself. But my prediction is that they will do it if they have enough sense of self-preservation, right, that in the end they will be forced to do so.
Now, let's just suppose we do finally come in the eurozone to the Europeanization of the fiscal and banking problems and the creation of political systems that go with it. This obviously would involve, in the long term anyway, profound treaty changes. Do you think that the eurozone members, given the frictions that have arisen in this crisis, will be willing to trust one another on the scale required to create such deep integration?
I have my doubts when you see how emotions in different countries, how strong these emotions are. In southern countries, a kind of very strong negative emotions vis-à-vis Germany, for example. And in Germany, the northern part of Europe, a very strong distrust in the capacity of these countries to turn around. Then, yeah, I'm a little desperate. So in other words, the deep variable that is necessary to sustain a political union and the solidarity that goes with it, that deep variable is not there. People don't trust each other. They don't want to bring up this kind of solidarity that is essential to make a monetary and a political union feasible. When you look at the contrast between, say, what happened in Germany 20 years ago, right? Surely is Germany that sinned worse than the Greek? There can be no doubt about it in terms of management of the economy and all that. Yet, West Germans were willing to start with a new slate and pour billions and billions of marks at the time into East Germany without any doubt, because there were German brothers and sisters. But today there is so much resistance because for the Germans, the Greeks are not brothers and sisters, right? So how do you make a monetary and political union when you don't trust each other? And that makes it very difficult. But maybe the realization that there is no other way than to move in that direction may slowly change all this.
An important emerging economy with a ringside seat on the Eurozone crisis is Turkey. Ali Babacan is Turkey's deputy prime minister. His country has had a great deal of experience with economic crises, most recently in 2001, when its currency and banking systems collapsed. Since then, it has made a strong recovery. So what does he think is needed in the developed countries?
Well, number one priority should be confidence. Number two, confidence. Number three, confidence. Number four, five, six, seven, you can count whatever you want. Because at the core of the problem, there is the lack of consumers' confidence so that they don't spend, lack of corporations' confidence so that even though they have cash in their hand, like the case of the U.S., but they are reluctant to do more business. And also for the case of banks, it is only confidence which make them do more business, continue lending, and so forth. So the governments should put confidence as the core concept of their policies and implement the rest of the policies, whether it's about fiscal plans or monetary policies or any other kind of plans that they are implementing, it should be the main theme. Otherwise, time has shown us that no matter how much governments spend money creating deficits, it doesn't get well anytime soon. No matter how much liquidity the central banks pump to the market, it doesn't get any better either. I think at the core of the problem, in many developed countries, we need a strong political will and strength to come up with decisions, maybe tough decisions, hard decisions. And for many leaders, these decisions are not going to be easy to be taken. But nowadays, it is time not to think about one's personal political destiny or any political party's destiny, but the destiny of the nation and the state is now at stake in many countries.
Ali Babacan, Deputy Prime Minister of Turkey. As the developed countries struggle, emerging countries prosper. Larry Summers was a member of two U.S. administrations, as Treasury Secretary for President Bill Clinton and Director of the National Economic Council for President Barack Obama. I asked him whether this success in emerging economies, especially China, will last.
When the history of our time is written, the principal story will be what has happened in Asia and what has happened with emerging markets more generally. More prosperity has been achieved more quickly for more people than any time in the history of the planet. That is a profoundly important thing, and it would be very surprising if that process was over. I think at the same time, it is important to remember that while forecasts invariably take the last decade's performance and extrapolate it to the next decade, statistical evidence suggests that the tendency for countries that fare well in one decade to fare well in the next decade is actually much weaker than most people suppose, with the correlation being quite low. That's why I think there is a tendency to over-extrapolate from recent success. We have seen this before. There was a very wide feeling in both the United States and Britain in the 1960s that they would be surpassed by the Soviet Union in the next generation. There was a pervasive sense of Japan's ascendancy in the late 1980s. And while there's an enormous potential in China, I think the assumption that Chinese growth will continue at the rates and with the smoothness that it has historically is not one to be precluded, but certainly not one to be relied on. And prudent planners will at least allow for the possibility that there will be significantly more fluctuation in Chinese growth with significantly more interruption in recent trends than has been the case in recent memory.
Larry Summers, University Professor at Harvard. So should we be cautious about the sustainability of China's remarkable recent economic performance? Zhu Min was previously a deputy governor of the People's Bank of China, China's central bank. He is now a deputy managing director of the International Monetary Fund. What, I asked him, should we realistically expect from China? Will it soon be the world's number one economy?
I don't know whether China will be a number one economy in the world. I have much less imagination than you have. Per capita GDP per se, you know, I mean, China's still very poor. And it remains that way for a long, long time. From global perspective, I think a stable Chinese economy is absolutely important. Because China, we call a systemic important economy, particularly through trade channel. And China plays a very important role for the region in Asia and also for other emerging markets and also to, in some degree, to the advanced economy now. So a stable Chinese economy, in terms of the stable growth and stable policy, is absolutely important for the whole world. But what we observe in the past few years, that China move more to the investment-driven growth model, which is not necessarily sustainable. So China should move from domestic investment growth model, move into further domestic consumption model. But when China move into domestic consumption model, they need obviously to carry more reforms. And the Chinese, the financial sector also play in the role in the global financial sector. It should be part of the global sector. That means China should continue the exchange rate reform, the financial sector reform, and bring them being the part of a global financial sector.
Do you think that the renminbi will emerge as a major world reserve currency within the next decade or so? And what effect might that have on the stability, as it were, of the system as there a new alternative emerges for the dollar and the euro?
In the past few years, we see the external demand on RMB increase. But RMB is still, first of all, it's not convertible. But I think the real issue is that RMB is not an investment instrument. There's no products. So when you open the RMB, let people hold the RMB, you have to let people to invest in RMB. Otherwise, it does not finish the circle. But that's a long process. That means you need to have products, you need to have RMB market, you need to have an infrastructure of this market, and you need a regulatory framework. So in that sense, there's still a long way to go.
Mr. Zhu's caution about China's prospects is noteworthy. A big debate has been over how far emerging countries are now decoupled from what happens in the advanced economies. Some even suppose that the emerging world's dynamism could pull the richer countries out of their long-term weakness. Mohamed El Erian of PIMCO has no such grand hopes. The fast-growing nations would do quite well if they saved themselves from the dangers that lie ahead.
If we are expecting somehow the emerging worlds to be the locomotive that can pull up the West, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. They can help the West, but they cannot pull up the West. The West is going to have to do it on its own. There are two possibilities when you look at healthy balance sheets on one side and unhealthy balance sheets. There's a possibility that the healthy balance sheets pull up the unhealthy ones, and there's also the possibility that the unhealthy one pull down the healthy ones. I think that unless the West gets its act together, it's going to be the latter, the unhealthy pulling down the healthy, rather than the healthy pulling up the unhealthy. If the West goes into recession, and if the West goes into recession and debt deflation with a banking crisis, no one will escape the consequences of that. No one. So this notion that somehow you've had complete decoupling is simply not supported by facts, nor is it supported by the mindset of policymakers in emerging markets. Policymakers in emerging markets are not going to press on the accelerator if they see the West going down the drain in terms of economic growth and debt deflation. So I think this notion that somehow the emerging economies can decouple from a crisis in the West is completely wrong.
So if they know this and they see what's happening, what should the leaders of the major emerging countries, the ones with weight, and we all know who they are, be doing and saying now to help, if they can, both themselves and the world economy get out of this very, very difficult situation?
So their heart is telling them, let's compensate for the weakness in the West by stimulating domestic demand. And let's do that by using all these reserves cushions that we've built. That's what the heart is telling them.
And that's what the Chinese did do during the crisis, isn't it?
That's what the Chinese did in 2008 and 2009. But the head is telling them something different. The head is telling them this is not 2008 and 2009. 2008 and 2009 was a financial crisis with the underlying global economy still okay. This is different. This is a global economy that is weak and a financial crisis that's coming on top. So the head is telling them, be cautious, increase your self-insurance. I think what you're going to see is a compromise between the head and the heart. And the compromise will be that there will be more expansionary when it comes to monetary policy, but there will be very cautious when it comes to fiscal policy.
While grappling with the immediate crises, the advanced countries must also prepare for the aging of their societies. Carmen Reinhart is co-author with Harvard's Kenneth Rogoff of This Time is Different, an influential book on the history of financial crises, and is a fellow of the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C. What does she think the combination of the immediate crisis with these longer-term pressures means for policy in advanced countries?
One of the changes of the game that the crisis has brought forward is the way we deal with financial markets. The problem of the debt, the problem of the aging and the contingent liabilities cuts across the advanced economies. And I think in that environment, what we are going to see is a revival or return to financial repression. And let me define financial repression. When we came out of World War II, the UK, the US, Australia, huge debt loads. They were entirely public debt. Private debt was very modest. But financial repression, which was essentially a system in which the financial markets were under much heavier regulation, interest rates were often capped or through various means kept very low, so that when you look at real interest rates after adjusting for inflation, you have negative interest rates. Well, negative interest rates when you're holding a bond is a tax on the bondholder. So I think pension funds are captive audiences, and pension funds, domestic financial institutions, are going to bear a big brunt of that tax. I don't envision a scenario in which we have a lot of excess capacity, high unemployment, so we have the cyclical factors that require really low and stable interest rates. And then we have the longer term factors that also require a rebalancing in which you either get less benefits, you're taxed more heavily one way or another, or a combination of the two things. I think that's not an uplifting scenario, but I think it's a realistic one. And I think what financial repression will actually take various forms that will not be called financial repression, but macroprudential. And already we are seeing elements of that emerge, for example, in the context of the more troubled countries, in Greece, in Ireland, in Portugal. The share of government debt that is held by domestic banks, over which the government can exert a greater force, is already been sharply on the rise. France has already directed some of its pension funds away from equity more into government debt. It is happening. It's not a conjecture about the future. I think that's already begun to unfold.
So we have the crisis itself, the rising role of emerging countries, and the longer-term pressures of an aging population on fiscal policy in advanced countries all coming together. This should bring about much tighter regulation of the financial system. But what does it mean for management of the global economy? Mark Malik Brown, a former UN Deputy Secretary General and minister in Gordon Brown's Labour government, is an experienced observer and participant in global economic diplomacy.
I don't think there's going to be a new Bretton Woods conference or a new grand Big Bang redesign of global governance. I think it's going to be a much more sort of spontaneous process driven forward by crises. After all, the G20 is a child of the 2008 financial crisis. But we'll look back 20 years from now and recognize that in a kind of ungainly, unlinear way, we've built some kind of cobbled together enhanced system of international management of our global agenda.
This is really quite an optimistic perspective. What could go wrong?
Oh, well, plenty of things. I suppose, perversely, the first is there aren't enough crises to drive the changes. But if there are, then what is likely to go wrong is you're going to just have these changes happening in too dispersed, devolved way across too many fronts. And it may be very hard to pull it all together into a system which has some coherence.
Some might argue that if you look at the Eurozone crisis, this is an example of trying too much integration. Isn't there a danger, actually, that we might ask too much from the international system, particularly when some of the major new players are so intent to preserve their sovereignty? We have to recognize that as a fundamental constraint.
I think we are in a time where, you know, in a sense, globalization, this great kind of economic sucking sound, which draws us all together into an integrated global economy, has created a massive political backlash. And the great debate of national politics in Britain, the US, anywhere in the world, is going to be between those who try to accommodate this new economic integrative force with a kind of liberal set of institutions which are transnational and respond to that, and those who cling on to national power as a reaction to it. And I think it will be as powerful an organizer of 21st century politics as class was of 20th century politics.
Mark Mallock-Brown, Chairman of Global Affairs for FTI Consulting. This tension between the globalization of our economies and businesses and the national identities that underpin our politics is an inescapable feature of today's world. Global companies think of themselves as global citizens, but the vast majority of people remain anchored to their national communities and attached to their nation-states. Is this divergence between our economics and our politics manageable? Back to Larry Summers.
To continue, global integration must not become identified with local disintegration. Fortunately, there's much where we live, where we shop, how we take care of ourselves that is not global but remains local. There are strong bases for strong local economies, albeit local economies connected to activities that have the possibility of selling things on broad markets. But it will be the central challenge of global political economy to assure that integration is something that does not just benefit mobile elites, but benefits citizens who are unlikely to be mobile, who neither have the kind of capacity that a Bill Gates has to lever and mobilize and profit from what is happening in a China or in an India, nor is prepared to simply compete with workers in those countries on the basis of willingness to accept lower wages. How that set of issues is resolved will be a central politico-economic challenge for our time.
Socrates, the Athenian philosopher, used to say that he knew more than other men because he knew how much he did not know. If the crisis has taught us anything, it is that. The world economy is in the middle of a huge shift in relative economic weight, while the advanced countries are struggling with waves of financial and economic crises. Nobody knows how this will work out. A way must be found to manage this turmoil. At the same time, policymakers need to find a basis for cooperation between advanced and emerging countries. So far, the world has managed to muddle through rather than succumb to another Great Depression as it did in the 1930s. That is a great deal better than nothing, but no cure is yet in sight. At the very least, we know one thing from history. In a crisis of this magnitude, no country is an island. They have to cooperate. That lesson was learnt at the beginning of this crisis. We will have to continue to act upon it in the trials that lie ahead.
Martin Wolf, the producer of that programme, was Sandra Cancel.